correct judgment, then they would have upheld justice, even though someone might end up in jail, even though someone might end up having to return some wealth or some money or whatnot. And of course, this is the intellectual and religious and wise kind of equilibrium that needs to be presented in a society. Because with all the controversy that we can see nowadays, and people being falsely accused of certain things, you know, and then later on them being acquitted from what it is that they were accused of being, it means that, you know, there must be importance in trying to make sure that things are done in the best way possible. We're going to go for a short break and we will be back very, very soon.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. While we were speaking about upholding of the law and making sure that we are as fair as possible in our judgment, and when we make reference to our judge is also someone who upholds justice in the best level of equality as possible, even though it might turn out that one side is not going to be happy with the final judgment. But at the end of the day, justice needs to be served. And this is exactly why Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, explains it in this particular way. This is how he starts off the right of the adversary. Haqqul khasm al-mudda'i alayk, which means the rights of the adversary who has a claim against you, who has an issue against you, and they are claiming that against you. فَإِنْ كَانَ مَا يَدَّعِي عَلَيْكَ حَقًّا, if that which they are claiming against you is true, then لَمْ تَنْفَسِخْ فِي حُجَّتِي, this means that you should not nullify their proof and reject their claim. If they are saying something that is truthful against you, and they are testifying something against you, and you know that it is true, then you can't just reject it, you can't deny it, you can't brand yourself as a liar and reject something that is obviously the truth. Or in other words, when there is something being testified against you, and you know that it is right, you should not in any way reject them or wrong them and give them the full due. And this is because your act needs to be in such a way where you are kind towards them, where you are nice towards them and polite towards them. Because, of course, obviously they are not attributing something false against you if you know that it is something true, and that's the source of the quarrel. Because when it does come to something like pursuing your needs and pursuing your requests or your desires, it doesn't mean that you go against your nature by attributing falsity against yourself or against anybody else. And this is why Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, in this particular segment, he says you should not nullify their proof, and also you should not abolish their claim. لَمْ تَنْفَسِخْ فِي حُجَّتِهِ وَلَمْ تَعْمَلْ فِي إِبْطَالِ دَعْوَتِهِ. You don't pursue to try to eliminate their claim that they have against you if it is something true. We're going to continue on in the next episode of For Humanity. Until then, please visit us on parstoday.com or email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim.
In the limelight.
Republican divisions over Donald Trump's second impeachment trial came into clear focus on Sunday, 24th of January, as the former president spent his first weekend out of office plotting revenge against those he says betrayed him. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, Trump Plots Revenge on Republicans Who Betrayed Him as Senate Trial Looms. Stay with us for more of Richard Luscombe's article. Republican divisions over Donald Trump's second impeachment trial came into clear focus on Sunday, 24th of January, as the former president spent his first weekend out of office, plotting revenge against those he says betrayed him. Stewing over election defeat by Joe Biden 4 days after leaving the White House, Donald Trump continued to drop hints of creating a new political party, a threat some saw as a gambit to keep wavering senators in line ahead of the opening of his trial in the week after 8th of February. Democrats will send a single article impeachment to the Senate for a reading on Monday evening. It alleges incitement of insurrection regarding the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol that left 5 people dead, including a police officer. Donald Trump spent the weekend at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, splitting rounds of golf with discussions about maintaining relevance and influence and how to unseat Republicans deemed to have crossed him, according to a report by The Washington Post. Trump, The Washington Post said, had said the threat of starting a MAGA or Make America Great Again political party or a Patriot Party gave him leverage to prevent senators voting to convict, which could lead to him being prevented from seeking office again. Later on Sunday, the New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman cited sources familiar with Trump's thinking when she said Trump was backing off his threat to create a new political party, after it was gently pointed out to him that threatening a third party while simultaneously threatening primaries makes no sense. Nonetheless, those in Donald Trump's crosshairs include Liz Cheney, the number 3 House Republican, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, and others who declined to embrace false claims of election fraud or accused Donald Trump of inciting the Capitol riot. Other senior Republicans clashed on Sunday over Donald Trump's trial and the party's future. Mitt Romney, the Utah senator and former presidential candidate and a fierce critic of Donald Trump, who was the only Republican to vote for impeachment at his first trial last year, said the former president had exhibited a continuous pattern of trying to corrupt elections. Mitt Romney said, he fired up a crowd, encouraging them to march on the Capitol at the time that the Congress was carrying out its constitutional responsibility to certify the election. Speaking to CNN's State of the Union program, Mitt Romney said, "These allegations are very serious. They haven't been defended yet by the president. He deserves a chance to have that heard, but it's important for us to go through the normal justice process and for there to be resolution." Mitt Romney said it was constitutional to hold a trial for a president who has left office. "I believe that what is being alleged and what we saw, which is incitement to insurrection, is an impeachable offense. If not, what is?" Romney, however, said he did not support action against Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, Republican senators who supported Donald Trump's claim of a rigged election and objected to results of the election. Mitt Romney said, "I think history will provide a measure of judgment with regards to those that continue to spread the lie that the former president began with, as well as the voters in our respective communities," he said. "I don't think the Senate needs to take action." Other Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska, are expected to vote to convict Donald Trump. But the party is deeply fractured. For a conviction, 17 Republicans would need to vote with the 50 Democrats. It is unclear if that number can be reached, despite assertions from Minority Leader Mitch McConnell that the mob was fed lies by Donald Trump. New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman said that Donald Trump had started to believe there are fewer votes to convict than there would have been if the vote had been held almost immediately after the 6th of January riot. Marco Rubio of Florida said he thought the trial was stupid and counterproductive. "We already have a flaming fire in this country, and it's like taking a bunch of gasoline and pouring it on top of the fire," Rubio told Fox News Channel on Sunday. Senator Rubio added, "I look back in time, for example, Richard Nixon, who had clearly committed crimes and wrongdoing. In hindsight, I think we would all agree that President Ford's pardon was important for the country to be able to move forward. I think this is going to be really bad for the country. It's just going to stir up even more and make it even harder to get things done." Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas threatened retaliation, tweeting, "If it's a good idea to impeach and try former presidents, what about former Democratic presidents when Republicans get the majority in 2022? Think about it and let's do what is best for the country." Mike Rounds of South Dakota said he believed the impeachment was unconstitutional, telling NBC's Meet the Press, "The U.S. Constitution specifically pointed out that you can impeach the president, and it does not indicate that you can impeach someone who is not in office. So I think it's a moot point. But for right now, there are other things we'd rather be working on. The Biden administration would love more of the cabinet in place, and there's a number of Republicans that feel the same way. We should allow this president the opportunity to form his cabinet and get that in place as quickly as possible." Republican unity appeared increasingly rare. On Saturday, 23rd of January, the Arizona Republican Party voted to censure Cindy McCain, the widow of the former senator and presidential candidate John McCain, and two other prominent party members who have crossed Donald Trump. The actions drew swift praise from the former president, who backed Kelly Ward, the firebrand Arizona State Party chairwoman, who was the architect of the censure and who recently won a narrow re-election. Donald Trump, according to a Washington Post report, called Kelly Ward to offer his complete and total endorsement.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. My name is Sheikh Zayd al-Salami. We're talking about how we are able to deal with ourselves and the importance of making sure that we take care of our body, our spirit, our soul. And of course, just reminding you that we're on part one of the book, which is how to deal with yourself. And of course, then we go on to, inshallah, later on into part two, how you deal with others, how to deal with others. And so when we're talking about making sure that you are not lazy, when making sure that you give your body a rest, making sure that you are observing all of the important things that would bring about a healthy kind of lifestyle, you know, continuing on from what we discussed in the previous episode, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli goes into talking about preventing of sickness. And he divides it into two kinds. One is the material, physical side of prevention, and the other is the mental, spiritual side. But without doubt, we know that they're both intertwined with each other. We know that in Islam, you know, there are so many things that are a combination of both. You know, an example for this, which is exactly what it is that Sheikh Jawadi Amuli starts off with, by saying that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will prevent a person from being inflicted with a sickness by the paying of charity and sadaqah. You know, and a lot of this, you know, does bring about that sense that we understand that there is always going to be the ghaibi side of how we are able to deal with our physical and mental health at the same time. And this combination is also very, very important. And it's also something unique about our religion, Islam. You know, that it's telling us that, well, look, by the way, you know, if you do this particular thing, which is a material practice, it's something that you're doing physically, it's going to lead you to this kind of spiritual, for example, or mental sickness. And, you know, let me give an example of this, where it says, of course, let me read that hadith first of all from Rasulullah. Inna Allaha la ilaha illahu la yadfa'u bis sadaqatil da', that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will repel a illness by the paying of or the giving of charity. So what are the means of preventing sickness and illness? You know, let's go through the different areas of what Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions as far as these kind of methodologies are concerned.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
One volume,
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامش گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری و ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
An example from the Holy Prophet. He says, لَا يَبِيتَنَّ أَحَدُكُمْ وَيَدُهُ غَمِرَةٌ. That nobody should sleep while their hands have dirt on them, while their hands are dirty, while their hands are oily. And, that's the kind of Farsi translation that Sheikh Jawadi used, saying oily or dirty. فَإِنْ فَعَلَ فَأَصَابُهُ الْلَمَمُ الشَّيْطَانِ فَلَا يَلُومَنَّ إِلَّا نَفْسَهُ. And if this was to happen, if he or she were to go to sleep with being dirty, with dirty hands, with oily hands, and some kind of infliction from the shaitan, some kind of shaitani kind of interference happens to them, then they should not blame anyone other than themselves. We understand that in Islam, one of the sunnahs of Islam is you doing wudu before you go to sleep. We've mentioned that any time you do go to sleep, you should go to the bathroom and relieve yourself. It's one of the sunnahs of Islam. You know, that's all to do with cleanliness. It's all to do with hygiene. And in many cases, there is a correlation between relating dirtiness to shaitan and cleanliness to something angelic. You know, we are going to explain, you know, that whole hadith of al-nadhafatu min al-iman. But this kind of simple explanation that tells us, for example, how we are able to avoid sicknesses. So cleanliness is one thing, and staying away from any kind of dirt or dirtiness is one way of prevention. Another way, according to many, many ahadith, is to minimize your food intake, not to eat too much. But qillatu ta'am is a way of you avoiding any sicknesses. And this is exactly why Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, قِلَّةُ الْأَكْلِ يَمْنَعُ كَثِيرًا مِنْ أَعْلَالِ الْجِسْمِ. That minimizing your eating will prevent many, many of your physical illnesses. Of course, you know, that's very clear. You know, even, you know, physicians speak about that. Doctors speak about that. Specialists speak about that. Nutritionists speak about that. And that's why when we're talking about all of these things, we need to remember all the time that we're talking about seeing specialists, we're talking about consulting with qualified experts in this field, dietists and nutritionists and specialists in food and things like that. You know, we need to always remember that doctors are always going to give us the right advice, the correct advice. As long as it all falls in line with what it is that our religion, Islam, is also encouraging us according to the authentic traditions, by the way. And that's why, you know, we have, for example, some ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that say that you need to always make sure that you
are consulting with specialists in the field. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream sweet.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Rishahri. And in the studio with us is our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Almiyah of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. Thanks for coming to the program.
Wa alaikum salam, rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
Continuing our discussion from previous episodes about alternatives to beating our children. So we remember from last episode that one of it is to remind a child of his position as the Quran has defined it, so that he would want to be good and behave well. Can you please list us for our parents the alternatives which they can use and implement for treating their misbehaving children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we talked about role modeling some time ago in this show, and we had many episodes about this, that role modeling is perhaps one of the best ways to bring about this love and this attraction towards perfection in a child. Basically, you want a child to behave in a particular way. As long as they have a good role model, they'll be behaving according to that, and so their behavior will be exactly what you want, towards good, because they have a good role model. So a role model really helps towards inner change. Coming to things related to discipline self. So having said all of that, it's very important to realize that reward and punishment and discipline itself also has a place. It's not that Islam says completely no to any sort of discipline. We don't want to go towards this extreme either, right? Just like you have certain Western theory of parenting, which completely remove all sorts of discipline and all sorts of reward and punishment, like the extreme levels of unparenting and unconditional love and those kind of things. No, Islam does have a place for reward and punishment, and it's actually, we do that all the time as parents. Your child does something good, or you want the child to do something, you bribe him with, what the wrong word to use, you attract him towards do something good by promising them a sweet, for example, or a reward, and the opposite as well, by saying that you get punished if you don't do this. So there is a space. It's just knowing when to use it and how to use it, and for what purpose are we using. It's a very temporary thing, okay, but it's still necessary, because at times what happens is that to bring about inner change, we need to break a shackle, we need to break an obstacle, and to break this obstacle, you need the person to try at least once, right? Take the example of swimming, right? You want a child to learn how to swim. Once the child is in the water, then they'll just figure out themselves out, and you don't need any reward and punishment. But it's that jump into the water where the child's like, I don't want to go in the water. There you just need to use a bit of reward and punishment, control a very temporary moment of controlling a particular behavior. Okay, and once in the water, you know they'll have loads of fun, right? So it's just that moment you say, okay, you know what? If you jump in the water, I'll give you this amount of reward. Or if you don't, then I'll give you this amount of punishment. Just to explain that reward and punishment has a place, because certain actions need to happen at a particular time. And so in that controlled environment, in that space of very short time, there's a need to use reward and punishment. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to ask you after the break to give us an example of when a child misbehaves and how we can use the reward and punishment system there. Stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this Israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic upbringing, and we're talking about alternatives to beating children when they misbehave. So you said that Islam does have the notion of reward and punishment when we are raising our children. I'm going to ask you for an example for when our child misbehaves and we want to implement this system to correct them.
Take the example of a toddler, a 3-4-year-old, whom you've told that they shouldn't hit their little sister, okay? They shouldn't pull their hair, and he does it once and he does it twice. And you've told him nicely, gently, you've explained to him, right? Then there's a need to take a further action to ensure that this doesn't happen, because it can actually become very dangerous. It's actually hindering any good relation with the sister, etc. So what you can do over here, for instance, is as long as you've told the child, and the child knows, and as you've satisfied all the other needs, it's not a moment where the child, for example, is very, very hungry or very, very tired, and they're misbehaving or they're pulling the hair of their sister because of these other needs. No, you've covered their physical needs, you've covered emotional needs, you've covered them, and they're in a state where they shouldn't be doing this, but they still do. Okay, you can take this child and very nicely, very respectful, say that I've told you not to do this. Okay, I'm not happy with you. An alternative to hitting is showing disapproval of action. Say, this action that you do, I don't approve it. It makes me really, really unhappy with this. This particular action makes me unhappy. Not that you make me unhappy. Not that I don't like you. No, it's nothing to do with you. It's to do with this action. Okay, this action is very wrong. It's a wrong thing to do. It makes me very unhappy. Okay, when you do this, the child realizes, because obviously the child is attached to his parents. The child likes his parents. He realizes that this is something that makes my parents really unhappy. If it goes to a certain point, you can actually even like show a level of unhappiness. For example, for the next 5-10 minutes, you speak very firmly. You're not smiling too much because you're very unhappy. Okay, you're kind of very gently ignoring as well, just that they realize that there's something that I did was very wrong over here. At the beginning of this, at the beginning of the first or second show, we talked about this hadith that says that, this is hadith number 306, that a person complained to Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam about his son, and Imam Kadhim told him, do not beat him. And then he says something else. He says, just forsake him and do not prolong it. So just ignore your child for a bit, right? Show this disapproval, but don't prolong it. Don't make it like a whole day or even an hour, right? Depending on the child's age and ability to understand, make it for a short period of time that you've shown him that you're very unhappy about this particular action, right? This will then lead to child remembering that this action is something that leads to disapproval of my parents, and therefore I shouldn't do it again.
And this goes all the way to children up to 12 years old. I mean, is it okay if a parent disconnects with their children, stops talking with them, for instance, for a whole day?
It shouldn't be prolonged to a whole day. And it shouldn't be done in a way that it then becomes a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old will actually not react very well to this. Like, I don't really care if it's taken as against a self-respect, right? It's usually used for earlier on age. When it comes to a 12-year-old child and above, this child actually requires more understanding. And you have to explain to him a bit more. This is where you talk about the consequence of the action, the real consequences, right? And this is where you have a conversation with a child, right? But even then, if it goes to an extent, you can use certain level of punishment, that things that the child likes, for example, to take those away for a very short period of time.
Okay, thanks. Let's go for a short break, and we'll be back for the rest of the discussion.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about alternatives to beating our children when they misbehave. So one thing that we said just before the break was the punishment and reward system was expressing our disapproval of what they are doing. What are other alternatives to beating our children?
Let me give another example. You've told a child many times not to drink their glass of milk, for instance, whilst running around, okay? You know, sometimes some children, they like to do things very actively, full of energy children. They pick up their glass and they're running around whilst holding the glass. And you've told them once, twice, and they know not to do it. They know that they'll end up bad thing. This time they do it and it spills, right? You go, the floor all wet. It's all messy. It was juice. It's very sticky as well, right? Now, you can scream and hit and do all these kind of things. We said, don't do that, okay? Alternative over here is to bear the consequence. You explain to a child, look, we knew we were supposed to do this, right? This was a very bad thing to do, okay? For us to learn that we should, and for us to remember, because I'm sure you forgot, you were very happy about something or you were enjoying a moment, okay? So you forgot. Just that we remember next time, all of us remember that we shouldn't be running with that glass of milk, we'll have to bear the consequence of this. It means you clean up.
That's a very interesting way to put it, because most parents would put it as a punishment. But what you're doing here, the suggestion that you're making, is not to make it as a punishment, but as a lesson.
Exactly. And you actually help him as well. It's not like you do it and that's it. I'm very angry. I'm not talking to you. You go and clean up. No. We'll do it together. I want you to feel the pain of bearing the consequences of your negative actions. And this is a way to bring about a discipline, basically. The child learns that when I make mistakes, when I do things I wasn't supposed to do, when I do bad things, there's always consequences. And this time means that I have to be on the floor and wipe the floor and clean up everything nicely. And what's very important here is that my parents haven't shown me that they don't like me or they hate me or that kind of stuff, okay? They're in my team, we're together. Just that I made a mistake, and actually even now that they have to suffer because of me as well, in terms of cleaning up. So this is another alternative to punishment, is to bear the consequence of the action, or bear the consequence of the bad things that we do that we were not supposed to do.
And I like about it how the message here is that we're on the same team, we're together. You're not a parent who is talking from above, from a superior level, but a parent who's at the same level of the child. And like I said, you're a team, and that really helps in having children collaborate. We have less than a minute. What other alternatives can you suggest?
Sometimes you realize that there's two things over here. One is that sometimes you realize that a very good way to discipline is actually to ignore, right? To do taghaful. We have many hadith about taghaful. It means to just ignore, right? To show that you know what happened, right? And you ignore it. What happens is that the child many times misbehaves because he wants a reaction.
Wants attention.
He wants attention or wants a reaction. He wants to see what happens. When you ignore, then what happens? The child doesn't want to do it. Because in the first place, they didn't really want to do it. They were just looking for an attention. They were looking for a reaction from parents. They were looking for something to happen. They were in a mood that, you know, sometimes children are in a mood. They want to see a big scream. They want to see something coming up to
exciting.
A fire to come up, basically. Something exciting to happen. When you ignore it, it actually stops them from doing that bad thing, right? You taghaful, you just ignore it. This is one situation of taghaful. Taghaful in other situations also that when you ignore it, especially this is in older children now, when you ignore it, a child feels actually honored. It feels actually respected. Let's say I got caught, for example. I don't know, I wasn't supposed to watch TV, okay? I still switch on the TV, 10-year-old boy. Switches on TV, watches TV. Dad comes in and surprises. Oh my God, my dad just spot me watching TV. I wasn't supposed to. Dad comes in and says, "Salam, how are you? Are you okay?" And walks back out. Just ignores it. Pretending I didn't even see you watching TV. The child, what happens now, feels slightly embarrassed. On one hand, feels respected that I didn't get told off or my dad didn't shout. And sometimes feels a bit shy and feels a bit embarrassed.
Feels like he let his parents down.
Exactly.
They expected more from him.
And he won't do it again. He will never disobey his parents in watching TV again. So this is one other way to do taghaful, basically. Not show any reaction or just ignore it. Basically.
And interestingly, that's not only for children. In university, those professors who saw children cheat in an exam but ignored it, In later exams, there was much less cheating in their classes because the children felt that they're letting him down. Thank you, Brother Mighdad. It's always a joy talking with you. And thanks, special thanks to our audience out there for whom we are here for. And we hope you enjoy these programs. If you missed our program, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and all our previous episodes from our website. Simply visit www.parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com, and find our page on Call of Islam Radio. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
On Wednesday, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States.
In his first speech as the U.S. president, he pledged to defeat political extremism and domestic terror.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
2 days later, Biden ordered the Director of National Intelligence to work with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security to conduct a comprehensive assessment of the threat from domestic violent extremism.
We're committed to developing policies and strategies based on facts, on objective and rigorous analysis, and on our respect for constitutionally protected free speech and political activities. Our initial work on DVE will broadly fall into three areas. The first is a tasking from President Biden sent to the ODNI today, requesting a comprehensive threat assessment coordinated with the FBI and DHS on domestic violent extremism.
The fast-paced move shows how seriously the new U.S. administration is taking the issue in the aftermath of the January 6th demonstration in which pro-Trump protesters overran the Capitol. The National Intelligence Office was created in 2001 after the September 11 attacks with the goal of combating international terrorism. The involvement of the National Intelligence Office suggests that U.S. authorities are examining how to pivot to a more concerted focus on violence from extremists at home.
People in the U.S. who don't want any more wars, who want money to be used for poverty and homelessness here, those people are now going to be cracked down on with the same policies that they're using to the right-wing extremists. And so I think it took a while for the Biden administration and the Democrats to do this, because I think now they're also going to use it to attack people on the anti-imperialist left, the anti-war left, who don't want any conflict abroad.
What happened in the U.S. Capitol raised questions about whether federal government, national security apparatus, that for decades has moved aggressively to combat what it called threats from foreign terror groups, is adequately equipped to address the threat of domestic terrorism. In U.S. Congress, lawmakers passed a measure requiring intelligence agencies to work on annual reports and strategic assessments of domestic extremism. Many lawmakers blame far-right, white supremacist extremism as the most dangerous threat in America. Indeed, they have evidence for their claim. A report conducted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows that white supremacists and other far-right groups conducted two-thirds of the terrorist plots and attacks in the U.S. in 2020. It says that anarchists and other like-minded extremists orchestrated 20% of the plots and attacks, although the number of incidents grew from previous years. These groups mostly targeted law enforcement, military, and government facilities and personnel. Last August, Michael German, a former FBI special agent, published a report in which it said white supremacist groups have infiltrated U.S. law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. The report said U.S. law enforcement officials have been tied to racist militant activities in more than a dozen states since the year 2000. It noted that hundreds of police officers have been caught posting racist and bigoted social media content. The report said the main reason U.S. law enforcement have failed to respond to far-right domestic terror threats is that they are involved in such crimes.
From the very beginning, the U.S. state intelligence apparatus, whether it's domestic or foreign, the FBI, the CIA, has been based entirely on the enslavement of African people, of indigenous peoples. And so this notion that Biden and the Democrats are going to crack down on racism within and try to eradicate it is kind of nonsense, because at its very core, the U.S. state has been repressive, has been based on colonialism, slavery.
Concerns about alleged relations between far-right groups and law enforcement in the U.S. have intensified since the start of the protest movement sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in the summertime. But when footage of the protest rally on January 6 showed some police officers were letting protesters enter the building, the authorities started to worry. Investigation shows that there were off-duty officers in the rally and helped others to storm the Capitol building. A poll conducted by Reuters news agency after the insurrection at the Capitol found that 12% of Americans have supported the move. With their enormous power, department-issued weapons, and access to sensitive information, police departments have become attractive recruiting grounds for white supremacist groups. Because of the secretive nature of such groups, it is hard to say how many officers are involved. But since 2009, police officers in dozens of U.S. states have been identified as members of white supremacist groups.
It seems that as Britain left the European Union at the end of last year, the inevitable was going to happen to the British economy as a direct consequence of Brexit, with goods, services and business essentially halting their flow between London and the EU, leaving the British economy gasping for air. Add to this the devastating impact of the COVID-19 virus, which has placed the country into its third lockdown, and there's no doubt that Britain is entering a double-dip recession as COVID-19 cases surge across Britain. With the full impact of Brexit yet to be felt until the end of the first quarter of 2021, the end of 2020 saw the British economy sink by some 2.6%, leaving it easy to predict that things will get a lot worse come spring as Britain sinks further into misery. The cases of COVID-19 in the UK has put the country at the top of the global list when it comes to the worst death rate in the world, with daily death rates in the last few days fluttering around the 2,000 mark, meaning the knock-on effect towards the economy is proving to be equally as fatal. All eyes are now on the UK from Brussels and the rest of Europe to study how they're faring since their departure from the bloc, with many keen to show that by leaving the EU, the future does not look bright, and it's hence aimed at discouraging others to emulate a Brexit of their own. Yet Germany, and in particular Deutsche Bank, have looked at the British economy and concluded that three major factors have contributed to the decline, with two of the main reasons coming from the impact of Brexit rather than that of COVID-19, something that the British will not care to admit. So just how big a fall will the second dip be for Britain? Will it be worse than the first one? And just how long will it take the UK to climb out of a very deep, dark and slippery hole that it's found itself in?
Well, GDP will shrink, likely between 5 and 25%. Depends on how long this lockdown will last, and we have now indications it will be another extension as happened throughout 2020, where initially we were told it was going to be 2 weeks. It turned out to be longer than 2 weeks, so we have to expect most of 21 is going to be a lockdown year. And that will, in that case, of course, we have to look at the bigger figures of GDP contraction, 25 to 30%.
Much like Britain, the EU has felt the impact of the COVID-19 virus. But unlike Britain, the EU has a multitude of industries and services that it can rely on to contribute to the economy, to sway things back into the black in times of crisis. Yet it seems that so heavy is the impact of the third wave of the pandemic been on the EU that the financial commitments made by Brussels have not caught up with the Eurozone, which could see as many as 19 EU states fall into a deeper recession as a result. Already signs are looking bleak for the EU, with the zone seeing its Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fall to below 50 points to 49.1, indicating a serious downturn in economic activity, sparked by the stringent lockdowns rolling out again across the EU. But the EU has demonstrated the ability to work together to find solutions. The 2008-2009 global crash was a fine example of such camaraderie. But with things taking an impact on a much larger scale this time round, will coming out of another recession prove to be more demanding this time round?
No, I mean, you know, that's not any more difficult. The problem is, why are we shrinking the economy artificially by shutting down everything and prohibiting business activity? Why are we restricting individual freedoms, and why are we particularly annihilating small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly in service sector, catering, all sorts of face-to-face type of businesses? Is this justified? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? There's never been any. And it doesn't make sense. And of course, the longer you do this, the bigger the contraction.
The future ahead now falls in the hands and arms, it seems, of the people of Europe as various vaccines are deployed to try and stop the virus once and for all. Yet the sheer logistical scale of such an operation coupled with the already crippling effect on the economy caused by the virus, will mean that many more will suffer before things start to return to any notion of normality for Europe. The end of the Cold War came as a huge relief to the people of the world, who felt that the bipolar world order tension had finally ended and the world could settle down and live in peace. However, it seems that the Western powers still needed a scapegoat to target, and hence the birth of Islamophobia was commenced, and in the process, the Western media created a new enemy. Yet in 2015, following a spate of numerous events around the world, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wrote a letter to the youth of the Western world asking them to ignore the media and reconsider the image of Islam. But it seems that the leader's message of 6 years ago is still very much valid today, as his words are well reflected in the ongoing spreading of fear and the spreading of hatred demonstrated by Western leaders towards Islam and Muslims in general. One only has to look at the far-right ideologies of ex-US President Donald Trump, who during his tenure instigated one of the most controversial and discriminatory laws ever passed when he executed his so-called travel ban on countries with a majority Muslim population. Although it was not Trump who started Islamophobia, he certainly added fuel to the fire through his words and actions.
I'm here to protest Donald Trump's racist, xenophobic immigration order, which is against everything that America is about and against everything I stand for as a human.
Yet the leader of the Islamic Revolution raised a very valid point 6 years ago, and is one that stands true more than ever today as technology advances and has encouraged the youth of the world to break down the barriers fabricated across the globe and use the tools and resources so readily available to educate themselves about the truth, hence exposing the lies and deceit created and encouraged by the likes of Donald Trump et al. When it comes to Islam. With some people being led to believe that Islam is the world enemy, so many fail to see the consequences of Western actions, either directly or indirectly against Islam and Muslims, hence proving that back in 2015, the leader knew that the time had come for enlightenment, and as the message stands as strong as ever today, sadly, the youth of the West are still falling to the influence of negative images, catalyzed and sparked by real extremists around the world, whose sole aim is to create division and tension between mankind. When the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo published offensive pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslim world reacted with anger, stating that the line between freedom of speech and respect for religion and faith had been breached, and saw the resulting attack on the HQ of Charlie Hebdo condemned by the world over, including Muslims, who were horrified by the extremist reaction. Yet the republication of the cartoons, as well as the rise of the far right that stemmed from the events, have seen a huge rise of Islamophobia in France, and is something that's almost been encouraged by French leaders who have failed to condemn the actions taken under the so-called pretext of free speech. Yet it seems that time is not a healer when it comes to such acts, as the rise of Islamophobia begins to gather pace across Europe, in part assisted by the French, exporting their model of Islamophobia across the continent, according to the international head of CAGE, an NGO based in the UK that fights against the discrimination against Muslims. Although the world is currently distracted by events such as the COVID-19 pandemic and various social political events around the world, some have taken a stance against the ongoing phenomenon of Islamophobia, making sure the problem is brought to the attention of the highest authorities. It's hence why some 36 NGOs from across 13 nations around the world have sought intervention by the United Nations to tackle the problem from the top, encouraging world leaders to take a stance against Islamophobia as they would any other form of discrimination or hate. What now remains to be seen is whether a change of president in the US and the lifting of the so-called travel ban will start a new era in the world order and encourage other world leaders and the youth of the West to take a new look at Islam and finally understand that hatred being spread by a small minority should once and forever remain a thing of the past.